what this proposed rule entails. Obviously, there's many details and specific provisions that if you have questions about, certainly either myself or a lot of the experts in the room can help try to answer for you. I'll just kind of do a brief overview background, and then Charlotte's going to come up and talk a little bit more about some of the specifics and some potential challenges with the way that the legislation or the regulation is written currently. So for those of you who may not be as familiar with kind of the process and how we got to where we are now, the Controlled Substances Act has provisions on who can accept controlled substances from the person who they've been prescribed to or the ultimate user, and that prevents anyone besides law enforcement from accepting them for take pharmaceutical collection take-back programs. And so the Secure and Responsible Drug Disposal Act, which was passed in October 2010, amends the Controlled Substances Act and basically gives DEA the authority to develop regulations for the disposal of controlled substances only in terms of providing ways for additional collection options to really expand beyond what is just being currently accepted by law enforcement agencies only. And so this is a little bit of timeline here. Most recently what happened with the DEA proposed rule came out, folks, if you remember, right before Christmas, I believe, in December, and they had a comment period, and a lot of you were part of either PSI's kind of few conference calls on this or had a lot of all your own internal discussion, and a lot of folks have submitted comments already, and so we're currently at a stage where the comments have been submitted to the DEA, and we're waiting for our final rule, and I don't think there's any official timeline that we have yet on that. But hopefully, we're all kind of hoping, obviously, sooner than later, because as was discussed in the earlier session at the state kind of government official perspective, and certainly other perspectives in the room, is that this kind of not knowing at this current time is certainly not helpful in planning for the future. So that's just a little bit of the background. And again, just some of the basics that the DEA rules expand collection options for controlled substances now is only, this is not related at all to the non-controlled substances, which are the vast majority that we've seen come through pharmaceutical take-back programs so far. But we can continue to hold take-back events with law enforcement staff presence. There's also an expansion of who can have permanent collection sites, and so the language is very specific here, but basically retailers are allowed to participate. Manufacturers are also called out as what they call authorized collectors as in terms of operating the kind of logistics and the requirements because of various reporting requirements and things like that as the DEA. And this proposal still requires in terms of storing and transportation. And mail back is an option. There's a specific provision that requires collectors of mail back to have on-site destruction, and we can get into a little bit of the details and what that means later. But basically, these are the three general areas where take-back of controlled substances is being proposed by the DEA, at least to kind of expand these new methods of collection. And so, as I mentioned before, we PSI with our broad brush of perspectives in terms of state and local governments across the country, obviously, partnering with various companies, organizations, universities, other NGOs, a lot of folks who are represented in the room are obviously interested in this. Well, we kind of took the pulse out there and see what people really thought about this. And so there was, in general, I would say, a lot of support for the various provisions, some of them being obviously the DEA requires or provides for commingled of controlled and non-controlled substances, which means that you don't need to have separate collection, and the main benefit that a lot of stakeholders see there is that there's less confusion for the consumer because we've touched upon it a bit this morning that an average person isn't going to know what a controlled substance is or isn't. So again, I mentioned before, from pharmacies who serve as collection retailers, they just have, partners in that effort as well. And that's where we get into the detail of the other authorized, who else is authorized to really collect. The DEA also kind of calls out flushing and garbage disposal as what they call non-retrievable standards. And so really it's shown that it's not the preferred way, certainly, of getting rid or disposing of your pharmaceuticals. So essentially DEA is discouraging that through this proposed rule, which a lot of stakeholders were pleased to see. Obviously, that doesn't mean that there's a solution offered necessarily, but in line, I think, with what a lot of folks in the room think, at least. And then another provision is essentially that it recognizes that law enforcement has a lot of its own procedures for existing procedures for handling, storing, and transporting these controlled substances, and that the DEA really doesn't kind of want meddle in terms of what's happening currently. So there's a little bit up to your interpretation there, and we can kind of discuss that later, but I think that in general, people are supportive that law enforcement can kind of continue to do what they have been doing. And again, we just, as I mentioned before, there is a mail-back option, but it is limited to collectors that have currently on-site destruction capabilities. Just to kind of summarize, obviously there's a lot of perspectives and nuances about this proposed rule here, but some of the provisions that were pointed out that we feel may either increase costs or result in a loss of convenient options. So that could either mean prevention of expanding the collection sites that are available, or perhaps current collection programs, or you know, one-day events or something that if they don't meet the DEA proposed requirements, may not be able to continue if they don't find, you know, ways around it or a different solution. And so we just have a few things listed up here. Obviously, if you're not separating out controlled substances from the non-controlled, you are going to be getting a larger volume of medicine likely at all of these collection locations. And so it may pose issues in terms of storing, transporting, and also paying for the disposal for a lot of these existing take-back initiatives. There's also a provision there that requires certain law enforcement staff to be present, and so that is kind of viewed as perhaps being too restrictive. There's also a very limited role currently as proposed for reverse distributors in terms of their potential to participate in a mail-back solution. Another kind of important or key provision that has been pointed out many times through, you know, the stakeholder comment period and really reaction to the DEA proposed rule is that there's no longer, because they want to prevent any potential for diversion, and that's certainly a worthy goal, of course, that we all are in line with, but they do prevent the separating out or inventory or counting of controlled and non-controlled substances. They kind of have to all go into the collection bin or the box that they have specific requirements for, and it can't be separated out. So there's a loss there in terms of data mining and data collection that's been really valuable, I think, in a lot of current take-back programs that we've learned a lot in terms of what's coming back and what are the quantities that might inform future prescribing practices. And so one of the potential, you know, comments that we've offered up is, you know, if they can have a specific exemption filed for research purposes only for that. And so now I'm just going to have Charlotte come up and she can go into a little bit of the details, and then we can kind of take questions afterwards.
Thank you, Stephanie. Well, good afternoon. It's good to see everybody that came back from lunch. That's great. You never know. I want to mention that I'm going to be going through the devil's always in the details from my perspective. And anytime a new reg comes out, I think it's extremely important for the stakeholders to go through it with a fine-tooth comb, figure out what they like, what they don't like, and then comment on it. So I wanted to mention that I'm going to be talking about the return part for consumers, but we've also commented on the impact on long-term care facilities and hospitals. So if anybody wants to access that at another time, at farmecology.com on our homepage on the news alert. You can go in and look at the regs and also look at our 18-page comments. So I want to know how many of you spent your Christmas vacation reading the regs and commenting, like I did. Don't you hate it when they do that? It's like, oh, I got it off my desk. Great, let's have a nice holiday and give everybody else a fun time. So I think a lot of us were a little dismayed at the timing. We were thrilled to have it come out, but it would have been nice if they would have picked a little, you know, after the first of the year would have been great. I'm not a lawyer, and so this is educational only. So don't do anything based on this in terms of your legal actions. So what I want to do is just point out for our discussion some of the concerns that we identified, which you've already pointed out, Stephanie, to some point, get a little bit deeper, just so that we're aware of when this reg comes out. And, you know, my understanding is we don't get another shot at this. So we're hoping that, I guess, who told me today 190 responses? Dave, I think you told me. We got 190 comments come in. That's going to take some time for them to get through that. But as excited as we are about finally getting here, I think we'd rather have them take another 6 months if they need it and get it right, because there's nothing worse than getting a new reg that doesn't work. Because then, you know, you really have to spend a lot of time correcting it. So one of the things is, this is just a real small one, just a little tweak. Right now, they're restricting it to the ultimate user, you know, you, the person that was prescribed for, or the person asking for you if you have died. And I think there's also that in between the page, what if you are incapacitated? So this is just a really small tweak. But again, we don't want to get people hung up that are perhaps incapacitated, can't get to a collection event, and are afraid to give their drugs to somebody else to take. So that was just a small one. Probably the bigger, one of the bigger ones that I know many of you have identified is the restriction on volunteer assistance. Because so many of you that have done take backs have used volunteers. You've had volunteer pharmacists sorting the controls. So now we're going to have a problem because you won't have someone who can take it from the car other than the sheriff. You won't have a pharmacist who can sort the controls, which means that the sheriff's department is going to end up with all of the drugs, and they're going to have to store those, transport those, and have them disposed. So the waste management company that might have been, I'm using that generically, whoever was doing the waste hauling for that event won't be able to take those drugs because they'll not have controlled substances embedded in them. So that's a real problem from my perspective. I don't know if you feel that way. So I think hopefully they'll pay attention and trust the field to be able to manage that. You've already mentioned, Stephanie, the no option for data collection. That's another, I think, huge disadvantage, not that every tape bag is going to have that, but we know there's been a lot of work done around the country with different groups that have done data collection, just trying to find out what is being left behind, what's not being used. Certainly there should be an option for research, and we're hoping that they will, that the DEA will actually work through that. Now, another piece of that is that they're actually requiring reverse distributors, and in some cases the pharmacy is supposed to send this to a reverse distributor. Law enforcement is allowed to take it to a reverse distributor. They're requiring reverse distributors to document it, but they're not going to have any data to document it with. So something's going to have to shift there, because having owned a reverse distributor, normally we would count every single drug, and that's not going to happen. So that's going to be interesting, too, and hopefully they'll recognize they have a little bit of a glitch there that they need to take care of. Another one that Stephanie mentioned that I think is extremely important is the current restriction in the regs that only a reverse distributor, or basically a licensed registrant, which would be normally a reverse distributor for DEA, could take these mail bags only if they have an incinerator on site. That limits it, I think, to about 4 companies in the country, maybe 5. So there's a lot of other reverse distributors that would be able to accept the mail back if this restriction weren't there. And it's really confusing to me as to why they would have that restriction when they are allowing, in the nursing home setting, they're allowing the provider pharmacy to put a kiosk at the nursing home, and then they're allowing the provider pharmacy to take that in the contents of that kiosk and send it to a reverse distributor. So how is that different from an individual consumer sending it to a reverse distributor? So I think that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And right now, having had experience in that industry, reverse distributors are extremely strict when they receive controlled substances. They have everything set up with their cages and vaults and so forth and all their protocols to manage this. They've even managed it down to the consumer level when there's been a recall, like the Actiq fentanyl lollipop years ago. That was recalled and came back to the company that we used to own, and that was all down to the consumer level. So there's really no good reason not to bring a classical, if you will, reverse distributor into the loop, even if they don't have an incinerator, because they're then going to consolidate these. They're going to do a witness burn at an incinerator, just as they do for all the outdated drugs that come back through the supply chain. And one thing that I think retail pharmacies could participate in on the mailback, and which some have done already, is to either promote a mailback or even provide, depending on how it's funded, either sell or provide the mailback material that could then go back to the reverse distributor. So that would be a way that they could work through that. There's also some lack of clarity as to how law enforcement at a take-back event or in a kiosk is going to get the drug to the reverse distributor. Are they going to be able to send those through common carrier like FedEx or UPS, or are they still going to be expected, you know, to have somebody literally drive it there, which I think is very problematic in a lot of areas? And then what kind of records are going to need to be kept by the reverse distributor? Many of us have been supporting the concept that we don't need to have a record by drug. We need a record of the packaging. So if we can track and trace the packaging that gets sent from the retail pharmacy, from the consumer, whatever the starting point might be, that would be sufficient. Then the reverse distributor never opens it. They just put it in their cage or vault, as the case may be, and then witness the burn. One of the next concerns, and the reason I'm hammering home this reverse distributor area is not only because I'm familiar with that, but if it doesn't work for that part of the supply chain, it's not going to provide you with the options you're going to need to run your programs. So right now, they're requiring the reverse distributor to have an item or package destroyed in 14 days. Many of the times, they have to have these hauled hundreds or even thousands of miles away to the incinerator. Right now, in the system, they don't normally send to employees. They usually hire off-duty police or something to do that. Given these rules, they're requiring two employees to accompany the load to the incinerator within 14 days. That means every 14 days, they'd be hauling small amounts, you know, to the incinerator. That's going to be unrealistic also. So we're hoping that the DEA will allow the current process within the closed-loop supply chain to apply to these also. Another piece of this is they're requiring this whole group of drugs, which would include non-controlled substances for the most part, to be stored at the Schedule 2 level, with Schedule 2 to the highest level of security, which would be your morphines and OxyContin and so forth. That means a vault. Normally, a reverse distributor only has a vault for the size that they would use in their normal business practice, because they're very expensive to put in and to monitor and so forth. So, again, I think that's going to be problematic. So, again, the devil's going to be in the details, I think DEA needs to get out more and talk to us, talk to the industry, because it feels like these rules were kind of done, even though they had years to do them, in a bit of a vacuum without really consulting with the people in the supply chain that are going to be managing these. So we'll see how that works. And then there's another requirement that they're supposed to use current inventory and reporting practices. That's not going to work, because currently we send out a 222 form from a reverse distributor, which would list every drug, and we would order it from someone. That's not going to work in this system. So that language hopefully will be changed and go to simply having a list of the containers, especially if they're commingled with non-controlled substances. Now, those were the primary things that identified on the consumer take-back. There's a lot of other items in this rule that actually surprised me because they got into the whole hospital situation. And while everybody is excited that they aren't promoting drain disposal, they're specifically saying to a hospital, drain disposal will be considered non-retrievable, and we're not going to tell you what we accept as non-retrievable. So now you're between a rock and a hard place in a hospital setting where you're worried about diversion, you're worried about, let's say, some of the staff, you know, abusing drugs and so forth. So that's going to be very problematic in healthcare. They're also saying that two nurses, when they waste the drug, are going to have to use a Form 41. that's an archaic form, even if it gets updated. Right now, we're using automated dispensing devices like Pyxis and OmniCell, where the drugs are all stored. The two nurses go back and they indicate in that electronic system that they've wasted these drugs and witnessed it, whether it's down the drain or however they did it. And then if they don't do that, they get pinged, or then their supervisor gets pinged, and then the pharmacy gets pinged. You go back to a paper system, you lose all of that. So I think those are things, again, that the DEA hasn't really considered. And I don't know why they went into hospitals for this response, because they didn't need to do it under this law. Nobody said, oh, and look at the hospitals. So that's interesting. And then for long-term care providers or pharmacies and long-term care facilities, the only option they gave in the rule was for the provider pharmacy to provide a kiosk. They require that that two pharmacy staff have to deliver it and pick up the drugs. Normally, the drugs themselves are only delivered by one person, so now you're doubling the labor for the waste, and they're not allowing any long-term care facility staff, even the director of nursing, to have access to that kiosk. So what happens if it overflows overnight or on a weekend or something of that nature? So again, not giving any other alternatives to long-term care and not requiring the provider pharmacy to do it. If I'm out in, you know, Butte, Montana, and I don't want to provide that because it's too hard for me to do that, then what's the long-term care facility going to do? So I think we've got a lot of interesting gaps that haven't necessarily been thought of. And again, I invite you to go and look at, we have even more listed in our response to this. And I invite you to take a look at that and think carefully about it as we move forward. The other quick thing I wanted to mention, the question had come up, John, I think you had mentioned it, about what about how the hazardous waste, you know, on the drugs and how do you segregate them. Our understanding, even though EPA recommended they go hands, our understanding is the household exclusion applies federally, and it applies in a lot of states unless the state has specifically said we're going to consider these to be hazardous. I know I talked to DTSC in California. They still allow the household hazardous waste exception, for example, in the state of California. I just wanted to mention that's why they can go to Comanche.
But I think it goes the other way.
Pardon?
The state has to adopt the household waste provision, which is available.
Well, that I can't respond.
That's been our experience.
Okay, well, then you probably know that better than me. My understanding was that unless they said differently, it applied, but that may not be the case. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. For questions, I'm going to have to do the dance again, so I'm going to come up and be near the phone. I'm hoping people are on there. So, questions. Margaret, you want to come up, please? And if you have questions, if you know that, please, you know, come on up already, because we've got a lot to cover this afternoon. Or then Cruz, which I understand is leaving, whether or not we're there.
Charlotte, thank you. And I think it's the first time I've seen you in person, but I've followed your work for so many years. So thank you for all of this. And I appreciate all your detailed analysis of the rule. I guess as an overall thing, I do just want to say that I was pleasantly surprised by the DEA rule, because I wasn't sure they would even approve retail pharmacy take back. So I think they've made a lot of progress in their understanding, and I think a lot of their progress and understanding came because local governments and others that were running take-backs educated them. So can you tell me what waste management and reverse distributors that you know of are doing to educate DEA and move them forward on this? Are you talking with them directly? Or?
No, they won't talk to us.
But then what can we do to help?
I think the only thing we, and I shouldn't say that, we haven't tried in a long time now, we kind of back off. But since Mark Caverly left, who used to be our liaison, they've just been very closed about seeing people. I've talked even to NASA, which is the state, National Association of State Controlled Substance Authorities, and the DEA has just been very closed right now. We did it by responding, you know, extensively to their proposed risk. I think that's the best thing you can do, is get it on the docket. Now that's done, so you don't really have that opportunity. But and I don't mean to be, you know, so negative, but I got to say, in over 40 some years of practice or being in pharmacy, this is the most tightly held I've seen them. And I think part of the reason is that now the drugs of abuse aren't, you know, the bad guys coming from Mexico with the the cocaine. It's the, they're seeing the industry as part of the problem, whether it's the film mill or whatever it might be. They're really seeing the industry as part of the problem. And I think that has made them very suspicious of the industry, meaning the whole supply chain. And I think that's made it much more difficult for us to interact with them. So it's very tough right now to be able to influence.
Any other comments or questions? Well, Cheryl, you're the first person I've ever heard speak on that. As you probably remember that day, I don't know if you remember, but you were the first person I heard speak about wave-line signals, and that was April. Thank you very much. Okay, we're now going to move into another segment for us here. Okay, back to this. So here we're going to have a brief presentation, about 5 minutes from each person. And the way we're going to do it, just because of the way the setup is, we're going to have them all come up here one at a time. Those that are on this list, if you could anticipate that we're going to come to you next and come up. So we're going to do 5 minutes quick and then some 5 minutes of Q&A. So there's a lot of stakeholders, as we talked about before. We're going to hear from each of them. And these are the key points that we were asking them to address. The current role in supporting drug take-back from their particular role. The current challenges and opportunities. How their current role may change, if at all, once the DEA rule is finalized. And then potential strategy for enhancing state and regional efforts with drug take-back. So we're going to start here with David Spackwood from the Wisconsin Department of Justice. David?
Thank you very much. Here's somebody, can you hear me? Good afternoon, everyone. Again, all I'm going to do is provide Wisconsin's response and or support of DEA's National Take-Back Initiative. As I stated in my opening comments this morning, the Wisconsin Department of Justice has been a real partner with DEA on this program, and from the six that we've done since 2010, we've really really tweaked it to a point where we're very, very efficient, and it's truly a collaboration of many state agencies and local law enforcement, and I'll show you some of the numbers as we go. 2010, DEA, which we have an outstanding relationship in the state of Wisconsin with, came to us and said, would we like to participate? There's one district office in Milwaukee, and they have a number of agents in Madison and Green Bay. But the rest of the state is basically, they have to either respond from Green Bay or Madison if they want to respond, if they want DEA presence in other parts of the state. We have six field offices all across the state of Wisconsin. So we partnered with them, again, great relationship. J.B. Van Hollen, our attorney general, is extremely supportive of the idea. He's a very pro-law enforcement attorney general and wants to do whatever he can to combat the significant increase in prescription drug diversion. Wisconsin National Guard, they have a drug control program in the state of Wisconsin that's also very aggressive. They volunteered to assist us and help us with transportation costs. So what we did is that with our six field offices across the state, we partnered with Wisconsin State Patrol that also has six regional offices, and we would have local law enforcement collect the drugs on a Friday. No, I think I got that on the next slide. Let me see. And then we would escort it. Yeah, here we go. Local law enforcement would collect the drugs on in their communities on a Saturday. We went out with an extensive media campaign promoting this, coupled with DEA, coupled with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And as it grew, our partnerships enhanced significantly. So they collected everything on a Saturday during the Take Back Initiative. They would store that. The local law enforcement agency would store the prescription drugs at their respective facility. And then on that following Monday, we would have agents manning every one of the Wisconsin State Patrol posts, and all these law enforcement agencies from across the state would come to the central collection points. We would then take them, we'd inventory them, document how much, where they came from and the quantity, and then we would escort them. Well, we put them in the Wisconsin National Guard transportation vehicles, and we would escort them, or the Wisconsin State Patrol would escort them down to DEA in Milwaukee. So our first one was in September of 2010. Like I said, it was sort of like the shakedown cruise. We had to figure out, you know, logistically how to coordinate, you know, getting drivers in certain areas where they're spending time in hotels and stuff like that. We only had 86 sites where people would participate, and total participating agencies were 78, and we got about 4,500 pounds. April 2011, we had 136 different sites, and total participants were 120. You see the huge jump we took, and that's because of the Metropolitan Milwaukee Sewage District. As Steve mentioned this morning, or no, as the mayor mentioned this morning, is just a great partner. They host something at Miller Park where the Brewers play every spring, and it's a community-wide effort that they brought it down there. So then, because DEA paid for all of the destruction or disposal of all this, MMSD said instead of them having to pay, they lumped it in with us and DEA, and the DEA covered the cost for the disposal because we ship it out of state. October 2011, you can see the numbers there. We're about up to 19,000 pounds. We're getting much, much better. We're promoting the program very, very well. 2012, and you can see we're ranked fourth in the nation. I think in the previous one, in October of 2011, we were third in the country. And I said, Wisconsin, third in the country? We were behind New York and California. And we're only a community of 5.7 million people. But I think just it shows that how the citizens of Wisconsin really jumped on board. And then 2012, we were fifth. And then we just had this last one, and we broke all of our records, and we had 45,000 pounds, 179 sites, and 151 participants. And it's all done, you know, of course, there's no cost to the individual. You know, law enforcement, it's all voluntary. Law enforcement does it voluntary. DEA provides the shipping containers, and Wisconsin National Guard contributes to transportation. We have our manpower and inventory, so it's really a great statewide effort, and I think the results speak for themselves. Oh, yeah.
I'm going to start with one. In terms of the, obviously, the collection that you're doing is very important.
Yes.
How do you see your role, the DEA, your role as a state law enforcement official changing with the DEA regs?
Of course, it depends on what the regs. Ideally, I think that the take-back programs would probably diminish significantly if you can drop off your prescription meds at your retailer. I know that's a huge hurdle to climb. I mean, that would save a lot of this. A lot of the personnel efforts and manpower costs associated with it. But if they would still have them, I think it's a great idea, you know, at least once a year, and we would continue to support it just as we have in the past. But I think it would be significantly reduced. As a matter of fact, I can't see us maintaining those numbers of 45,000 pounds, because eventually people, I cleared out my medicine cabinet, eventually you're not going to have any more left. So I envision that, even though I know the prescribing numbers continue to grow, but I think with public awareness and things are going well.
You're good. All right, well, we're going to skip the next question. Is there already in? Introduce you. We have Paul Milgrave from Jefferson County, Wisconsin, and Paul is going to speak from a local law enforcement official's perspective.
Thank you. Sharon asked that I come and speak today, and I have to say, I've known Dave Spakowitz for a long time, great guy. The program that they're running through the DEA and through the state of Wisconsin is awesome. I did laugh when he said that, you know, we'll eventually kind of maybe we won't have such big numbers. I don't know if that's ever going to happen. The local police departments in Jefferson County, I said, don't worry, 6 months from now you aren't going to see these numbers continue. They have to dump every week, twice a week. We just can't keep up with the numbers that are going out. Every community has it. I thought it would affect my numbers they just keep coming. I hope you're right. There's a lot of police chiefs that hope you're right, because they never let me forget that I said, don't worry, 6 months to a year from now, things won't get used, or we'll have everybody's drugs. I was way wrong. We're very fortunate in Jefferson County, and I do mean that. We have a great working relationship with our zoning department, which actually handles all of our solid waste, and Sharon got us hooked up with this program, and we really did jump on board. Veolia has been just super. Marquio has just been great to work with. They're a great partner. We see a little bit differently than maybe some of you do from a local level. The storage issue for us is going to be humongous, and for all of the local police chiefs. That is our biggest issue. I believe we have, if there's a program that's running well, I do believe we've got a great program, because we all do play nice together in the sandbox. We do sort. We have volunteer pharmacists that sort under the direction of me. It doesn't cost anything because I'm there. We take them out at our 4 clean sweeps a year. Every community basically has a drug drop box. Since I'm the sheriff and I have to be elected, I can't really say no, so I ended up with all their drugs when they bring them back in. But we get rid of a lot, and by sorting is the huge issue for us. Just getting rid of the containers probably gets rid of almost a third to two-thirds of what we have. Being able to sort out the control from the non-controlled, I admit my Latin's not that good. I don't always know what the meds are. And so the junior pharmacists get a lot of fun when they're in training that come down and assist. But the problem is I can store small containers. I have a hard time storing 50 and 100-gallon barrels full of drugs. I run out very, very quickly of storage space. I don't have that ability. And that is going to be an issue for us. That's why, from our perspective, I'm really hoping that they continue to allow local law enforcement to do it the way they do have been doing it, by allowing us to continue sorting on-site under the direction of trained pharmacists, so that we do have that. But again, it's been going very, very well. Jefferson County actually allows for any agency in the state to bring their drugs to us. Mark sets up a day, and we actually travel down to Sauget, Illinois, with the controlled substances and take them down. Last year, we would have had probably somewhere in the vicinity of about 8 tons, but one of the agencies kind of goofed up and sort of forgot, so we went down with about 2. It was a little bit of a mix-up, but it was a little difficult to try to pack it into the vehicle we were going down in. But this is an ongoing thing, and in some ways I am concerned about getting rid of the sort, because we have had such great local response and people have taken such initiative to get involved that it is something for us that's very, very huge to be allowed to do that. So we will be pushing for that with the DEA regs to continue to allow us to do that type of a program. But it's just been a fantastic, successful program, and everybody that I've dealt with in the program, some of you I've seen in the room before, you're very, very passionate about it, and that's what's got this program off the ground. So thank you.
So this is a local law enforcement perspective. Any questions? Mary Ellen?
Sauget? You know what? If you ever have the opportunity to go there, don't. It's right outside of St. Louis. Instead of going across the Mississippi, you turn first. If you hit the water, you're a smidgen too far, but you're in the general vicinity.
Sheriff, don't go in that direction. She's from
Sauget. I'm just going to hold up.
You will hurt some wine or something. Any other questions or comments? Yeah, Walt?
I guess I was a little confused from the previous presentation. Are you going to be limited to how long you can store, or is it just the reverse distributor?
Well, that's what we're trying to figure out, because the problem is, even if it's a reverse distributor or a group like Veolia, Mark's going to tell you right now, they don't have the room to store by mixing. If they're mixed, it's much more difficult. They have a safer vault area, but the problem is, again, if I bring down a container that's basically the size of, well, an old-style ice cream container about that big, that high, I can get it full at every clean sweep that we conduct each and every time. I probably will take out 8 barrels of non-controlled drugs, 6 to 8, and another 4 or 5 barrels of plastic containers that we use for recycling. Now, so we're not just wasting and burning everything. We're actually recycling the plastic bottles. We're saving the space because it would eliminate me. I mean, I hate to say this, but in reality, if I had to store all of this for once or twice a year and other agencies were bringing it to me, their willingness to jump on board and say, yes, we can take another test that's unfunded and we have no room to start with, it's going to be difficult for them to jump on board with this or even maintain with it.
I guess my concern is if you have to move them out every 14 days, is that for law enforcement?
No. No, I believe that's reverse distributors. Ours.
Okay.
I just want to answer his question.
The way I want me to talk into that.
You guys can correct me if you think differently. The way I read it is law enforcement basically gets to run their own program because, you know, they are the equivalent of the DEA. That's the way I read the reg. So any program which is run by law enforcement will likely be allowed under the new reg. That was the way I read it.
That's the way I wanted to read it.
I got.
I was just going to say it wasn't how I read it, but I read it that way.
Now we have the point of counterpoint.
Sorry. No, I mean, I'm happy to be corrected, seriously, but I read it that it meant that law enforcement could no longer sort. They have to have 2 people accept at the desk. Or they can have everything put in a container. Once it's in that container, commingled, whether sharps got in there, whether it's empty plastic bottles, whatever it is, all of that, they can't touch that. That's what I read, and that's why my police departments have told me they're going to stop doing the program.
And doing it in a safe fashion, it's an excellent thing, and I guess the DEA take-back program, although it's a wonderful program, they don't do it every day. It's once, twice a year. Now, I don't know about anybody in this room, but most people's schedules are slightly busier. And the problem is, I believe we're trying to get the public to make those drops, not just at our clean sweeps, not just, you know, when they go, but when they go and throw the stuff in. The idea behind not having a controlled substance, you know, I always laugh. You don't want anybody getting stopped for something, but honestly, when they throw the pills in, I don't ask who threw what in. I just ask if they have garbage bags full. Don't stand there and feed it into my thing. Call in my jail lobby. My jail staff will call and tell me, just a second, we'd like to get the sheriff in.
That's why they listen to you. You say that in jail.
and we take it in one lump and just haul it out. But there's never been a sort that's been done that we haven't had sharps. And the aerosol containers, the inhalers.
Mercury.
And I won't get it. I always laugh when we get mercury because years ago in school we used to push it around with our finger. Now that may explain some things. I don't know. But.
All right. Well, Sheriff, sure, thank you very much. Okay, we're going to hear from another local government official, but not from the law enforcement, but from solid waste management. And Bill Leonard from Edmond County, Minnesota.
Hi, all. I don't know. Some of you guys were talking about what I was going to talk about here. let's get started a little bit. Hennepin County was a little late in Minnesota getting in on the drug take-back. We started in 2010. It's a joint project between our Sheriff's Department and the Department of Environmental Services. The Sheriff's Department does most of the on-site collecting hands-on for the drugs because we're taking both controlled and non-controlled. And Environmental Services, who I work for, takes care of all the permitting, paying for the disposal, and et cetera, and et cetera, et cetera, arranging all the meetings and everything that we have. We started, like I say, in 2010. We started with taking along with events. Most of you have been in household hazardous waste and seen something similar to this. When we did it, we had pharmacists on site under the observation of the law enforcement, and we did this in the tie-in with the September 25th, the take-back of DEA in 2010. We wanted to continue on into 2000. Whoops, did I skip one? We continued on with this, I guess, in 2011 and did four more of the event-type collections along the same lines. We didn't go through quite the sort that we did because we felt we had enough data to identify some of the material. One of the events, the first one we had, was some of the worst weather that I think I've ever been on an event on. It was cold, rainy, the temperatures were in the 30s, and we had high winds, the tents were blowing down, and right after that, law enforcement came back and said, we don't want to do this anymore. When we had originally put this together, we had looked at the basically three different options that there are for collecting pharmaceuticals. One was the mailback programs. Because of the potential for diversion, our sheriff did not want to do that. The events is what they wanted to do, and then drop boxes. After, in 2012, we set up drop boxes. So we set up three of them. One was in our public safety facility or jail. The other was out at Water Patrol, which is one of their auxiliary headquarters, and then their enforcement division patrol headquarters. As you can see, the med boxes, we've gone with those. We liked them quite well. And then as part of the group that we were looking at, we also looked at continuing the events of going into senior facilities, living facilities. And that is interesting because there's different types of facilities. You've got assisted living, independent living, assisted living, mental health living, Alzheimer's care, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, I think for everything in there. Well, in order to handle these underneath the hazardous waste rules that Minnesota has and everything, we pretty much is limited to independent living and assisted living with non-nursing support. We set up and did a couple of them as a pilot in 2012. It was fairly successful. The sheriff's department was very happy with it. We expanded it and added four more. Six more, I think, into 2012. Also, then we went in and added an additional three receptacles. These are in our courts or service centers, we call them. One of the things that we've got in the service centers, there's courts that are in them, there's a library that's in them, we've got licensing, all this is all tied together in the same building and everything. And I'll kind of touch back on this as I come back through, but this is more background than what we're doing. And so we set those up. This year, we're looking at putting together, we haven't started them yet, we're going to have 3 days of collections covering 26 senior care facilities. So it's going to be a busy day. Those with the Sheriff's Department goes out and basically comes in for about a half hour and collects any drugs from the residents there. And our sheriff has been very, very supportive of this. Rich Stanis is the sheriff there, and he's been a big push along with our people. The thing on the regs, and John kind of mentioned this in the definition, if you look at the regs in there, collectors there's a big definition in there, and they define who collectors are, and it's not a law enforcement agency. So when you start going back through those and looking at the definitions, the only place that they really restrict law enforcement of not having their own program is the libraries. Everything else is recommended that I can remember. I haven't run across anything. I went back through it, and like the lady is over here, when I first read it, I thought we had to do it. And we went back through and re-looked at it, and it doesn't look like law enforcement, as long as they've got their own procedures in place, they can do pretty much whatever they want to with it. And I think, since Scott's trying to hustle this up, I'll close it up right now. I don't think I had anything back to that. So, again, so.
This is really tough to do, just 5 minutes, the whole program. Thank you. Just want to see if there's some questions for you here from the local government perspective. Any questions for Bill from local government? In terms of what you're doing, we talked about the DEA rule. So what are you concerned most about? What are you excited about? How they can affect your program on the ground? You're doing a lot of collections in a lot of different places.
The immediate program I have, I don't see much impact on it unless they come back and say, with his libraries and everything. I know our sheriff's department's talked to the DEA, and they said, as long as you've got your procedures in place, continue on the programs the way we've got them. There's some concern with, like, particularly the three locations that are in the service centers. They're changing cameras. That's one of the things, too, our patrol or the sheriff's department, with the computers that they have, they've got cameras, and they're tapped into watching the boxes anytime they want to pull them up and look at the visuals on them. So they are being monitored that way. We use met returns. We put them into basically a banker box size material. They're sent up to the solid waste incinerators at Jennifer Park. And get rid of them at that point. The big thing that we see probably more than anything is trying to get pharmacies and other agencies to take it back, because that's the other thing. As environmental services, we're going to be promoting product stewardship, or we do support it and stuff. And there's a lot of restrictions in there for some of the pharmacies and the requirements to jump through. So we'll have to see what happens when the final versions come out. But that's basically what we see is the lack of supporting pharmacies to get them in there. The immediate program, not so much except for staff time for the sheriffs and everything.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Trip over this wire before the day is over, very nice. Okay, we're going to move now to the pharmacy perspective. Tom Engels, Pharmacy Society in Wisconsin. Tom?
Good afternoon. I'm going to kind of give you a different perspective from this, and what we would like to do is talk to you about a program that was launched by the Pharmacy Society of Wisconsin. The Pharmacy Society of Wisconsin is the only organization in Wisconsin that solely represents the interests of pharmacists. And the program that we started to work with and launch here in Wisconsin works with patients to better control the medications and make sure that they better understand the medications that they're using. We estimate in Wisconsin there are 5 million prescriptions dispensed in the state of Wisconsin every month. So to give you an idea about the volume, if you think the volume is going to go down, it's not. It's actually going to be it's going to be going up. And that estimate that I give you is probably a few years old. The program that we launched is called... It's called the Wisconsin Pharmacy Quality Collaborative. Thanks, Steve. Wisconsin Pharmacy Quality Collaborative has a number of steps that the pharmacists and the pharmacies have to go through. In Wisconsin right now, as of yesterday, there are 150 pharmacy providers that are already accredited to perform the WPQC steps. There's an additional 200 that are in the process of completing the steps. There's 1,000 pharmacists that have already been accredited through this program. There's an additional 300 coming online. PSW, the Pharmacy Society of Wisconsin, launched this program about 4 or 5 years ago. Russ Jensen, who's one of the speakers today, was actually on the PSW Board of Directors when this whole program was put together. The biggest component that we wanted to make sure that we got included in this whole thing was to make sure that Wisconsin Medicaid got on board on this, because Wisconsin Medicaid can use this as a way to control costs, but also control and make sure that the patients that are using the medication understand what they're doing and how they take their medications. Wisconsin Medicaid signed up and launched the program beginning September 1st, 2012. DHS, Department of Health Services, is currently going through a process to certify vendors that will come up with a process that will certify vendors that will pharmacies will sign on to in order to get the number of patients that will be coming out to them. They will have a complete listing of all those patients, and then they'll have a patient profile for each one of those patients that are coming through. It's important that this HIT system get up and running as soon as possible. Why? Because right now, pharmacies, although they have a list, there are two different pieces of criteria or process that a pharmacy will go through. A level one service, patient comes in, and they'll say, Mrs. Jones, you're coming in 3 or 4 days late for your blood pressure medication, and they'll explain to her why it's important that she comes in and takes those medications on a regular basis, why it's important that she comes in and gets them refilled on a regular basis and on time. That's a level one service. A level two service is taking Mrs. Jones, say, having her come into the pharmacy and going through all of the medications that she's currently on, explaining to her why she's on those medications, and in some cases, working with Mrs. Jones and then working with her provider, her physician, to say, let's take a look at some other medications that could be used for Mrs. Jones that would help better treat the symptoms that she's been identifying with, and to use those to better, and in some cases, you may actually see an uptick in the number of prescriptions that are written, but Mrs. Jones will actually be better off in the long run. Paramount that we get pharmacies involved in this whole process, and that's why PSW has hired extra staff just to get pharmacists accredited and certified through this process. This is a very long process. Pharmacies, once they commit to it, and pharmacists, once they commit to it, have to take extensive study, become certified, and agree that they will follow all those steps as they're dealing with these patients. It's important that the HIT system that we talked about get up and running, as I said earlier, because without it, pharmacies will not have access to all the patient data that they need. It's important when the patients get identified by the pharmacy that once the pharmacist sits down with them and is able to sit down with that patient, they have all the patient records and all the patient information in front of them. It's hard for a pharmacist to sit down and say to Mrs. Jones, okay, what medications are you on? I have a list here of some of the medications. Why are you taking this? Because in some cases, the pharmacist may not know. Mrs. Jones may not know. So it's easy for the pharmacist if they can look down, see a computer screen, and see all the information about that particular patient, and then work with the patient and then work with the patient's providers. How important is this program? This is a very important program. The Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services saw this as such an important program that they awarded the Pharmacy Society of Wisconsin last year a $4.1 million grant to help train pharmacists and fully implement this program. This is the largest grant ever awarded to a pharmacy organization in the United States. Why did CMS do this, and why do they want Medicaid to get on board with this? CMS has estimated that if Wisconsin Medicaid fully implements the WPQC program and the MTM program, they will save approximately $40 million over the next 3 years. So not only are we going to be saving money, but we're going to be better educating the patients and making sure that they're better utilizing their medications. To give you an example, we recently came across some information that when we're working with the Department of Health Services and the Wisconsin Division of Public Health, and we're trying to figure out a way to identify cardiac patients that are not being strict with the way they take their cardiac medication. They're not following the regimen. And then taking those patients and identifying them to see what happens when they don't identify take their medications properly, and to see how many of them actually end up in a nursing home. Again, has higher costs for the Medicaid program, higher costs for the healthcare providers. This program is not only signed up for the public sector programs like Medicaid, private sector programs. Unity Health in Madison area has signed on to this program. United Health in Wisconsin has signed on to this program. This program is going to become a model for other state organizations and other state Medicaid programs across the United States become a model for it to copy. That's why CMS has signed on to this program. That's why CMS is helping to fund this program to train pharmacists, because they realize if this program is fully implemented and implemented properly, it will save public sector dollars, but it will also better control the medications that patients use. Thank you.
Great, thank you, Tom. Questions? Come on up.
I hope we get away from the court. Back to it.
Okay, thank you. And this is Charlotte again. How are you handling a situation where the patient might be getting some of their drugs from Walgreens and some of their drugs from one of the, you know, mail orders, for example? So how are you getting the whole profile available?
If they're getting it through Wisconsin Medicaid, more times than not, they're probably getting them from one pharmacy. If that patient is going through a Medicaid program. But as far as like a mail order program, as long as the pharmacy has access and knows what medications they're on, they could still go through the level one, level two services. But that is a problem. One of the things that we've always advocated for, you know this, Russ knows this, Donna knows this, any other pharmacist in the room, it's important, and we advise patients, if possible, get all your medications from one pharmacy.
And then what about long-term care? Are you working with the provider pharmacies yet? Because that would be another place where you could impact that, for sure.
This is mainly working at the community pharmacy level, but as the program grows, it can certainly be taken into long-term care and other areas. Right now, they're concentrating on four major areas: cardiac, asthma, diabetes, and some elderly medication or elderly chronic diseases.
That's terrific.
Yeah.
I wondered if this is duplicative or in addition to the PDMP, and if there's any interplay between the health information exchange you talked about and the...
It can be. PDMP, Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, was launched earlier this year, where pharmacies, when any controlled substance or tramadol is dispensed in the state of Wisconsin, Wisconsin is one of the last states to actually implement this, there is now a central data bank where all that information is collected by the state of Wisconsin. Pharmacies, healthcare providers can access that information to see what controlled substances a patient is receiving. Yes, this program can work in conjunction with that. However, because that information may not be completely up to date, as long as the patient is getting all their medications from one particular pharmacy, the pharmacy already has that information. You can sit down with that patient. So it does work hand in hand a little bit, but if they do shop around a little bit, it might give access to that pharmacy as they're going through that level two service with that patient to help them go through that process. And one thing that needs to be understood, a lot of times when you go to a pharmacy and you actually wait to talk to the pharmacist, there's a reason you have to go through that process. Wisconsin law requires that pharmacists do a consultation with every prescription drug that's dispensed, whether it's an original prescription or a refill. And the reason the pharmacist wants to go through that with you is the pharmacist has taken a look at all the medications that they know that you've received, at least from that particular pharmacy, and they want to make sure that there's no problems with any other medications that you're going to be taking. And they want to talk with you before that medication, that last check before it goes out the door.
Walter Willis from Lake County, Illinois. I'm assuming it's your hope that through this dialogue with the patient that they're going to use their drugs more properly and maybe not have as many unwanted drugs left over. Is that one of them? I know it's not your goal, but is that an intention?
It's to make sure that they're taking the drugs properly. You may actually see where some patients actually get more medications given to them, because there may be opportunities where the pharmacist and the provider, by working together, may say, you should be on a blood thinner medication. And the physician may say, I didn't know that they weren't on one. Yes, let's get them on one. So it might be an opportunity where they could actually see an increase. Or you could have, you don't need to be on that medication because you're on this medication. It could have worked both ways.
Do you have any discussion with them about what they should do with their surgeons that they don't need? Is that part of the dialogue? Hey, here's what you do. If you have drugs, you don't need anymore.
I don't believe that's part of the WPTC. I don't think so, but I can ask, and maybe that is something the pharmacies could be providing that kind of information to patients.
One last question here. This morning we talked about the role of financing for pharmacists and other retailers and other products. They wanted to do their part for taking back medications other products, dispose of them, and the financing was so very important. How much of a barrier do you see to financing for pharmacists in Wisconsin and versus maybe some of the other barriers for collecting the unwanted medications?
You know, it's interesting. Pharmacies in Wisconsin are geared, like pharmacies anywhere in the United States, are geared to dispense the medication. But they're really not in a position to take them back. But I think pharmacies in Wisconsin want to be part of the solution to helping to deal with making sure these drugs aren't out on the street. And they want to be part of that solution. I think as we go through this process, if there is a mechanism put in place where patients can drop the medications off and a pharmacy can have some ability to recover their costs for disposal of those medications, pharmacies will be the first ones in line to say, get that stuff to us, let's help you get rid of these medications that are not being used and make sure they get disposed of properly.
Thank you very much. Hey, our next speaker is Russ Jensen, and Russ is a founding member of Dane County, Wisconsin MedDrop Program, and also with Safer Communities Coalition. Russ?
Good afternoon. To introduce myself before, I've been involved in the MedDrop program within Dane County since about 2004. One of our pharmacists within the Dean system, a drug information pharmacist, saw a program that took place in Indiana and came to me and asked if she could look at the possibility of starting one in Madison. And I thought it was a phenomenal idea. It was a time when some of the articles were coming out about the groundwater having drugs in them, and some of the pictures you saw earlier of the frogs and the fish. And so we began the process. It actually took her. She was the lead person in pulling everybody together from the state, from the federal, from the city, county, together to look at the options. A few of them are listed up here on this slide of the organizations that are involved, but there are actually many more that had to provide input into it. Because we were early in the process, there weren't very many models to follow. So it really had to be developed. And we began with collection events. So the first one actually took place in October of 2007. And you can see the numbers up there, the volunteers. We had volunteers that directed traffic, and then they picked up the medications, brought them over to a table where at that point we did sort them with the controlled substances in one container. Everything else went into a different container, and then pulled out thermometers and things that we weren't supposed to get that went to clean sweep, and also had a variety of inhalers that we received that had to be handled in a different manner. And you can see in the bottom there that in that particular one, we got a fair number of cars that came through with well over 500, and the pounds, we were very satisfied with the amount that we received from the first one. You can see the picture on the top slide there of the car. The back seat is filled with medications. The trunk you see is open, so that was filled with medications as well. And I don't think this would follow the DEA standards because I suspect that this person collected from neighbors and brought in others. We also had people that tried to drop them off, which we discouraged and tried to send them back, that brought them in from the veterinarians and others that were not really household. They were trying to get rid of them as well. And as much as we could tell, then we would tell them we couldn't take them and would send them on their way. And then we sorted them. In the bottom, you can see there's a container with like a coffee can that's just filled with medications that have been taken out of the bottles. And we did the same thing, that we wanted the bottles to be handled and recycled separately. So we dumped everything, the tablets and capsules. Another one, you can see the container in the bottom left-hand slide. We didn't dump out liquids and ointments. Those went in, and so we did pay for the bottles in those cases. Even had some people come in on their bicycles to deliver their medications. As we got towards the end of our take-back programs, we had three different sites within the city of Madison or in the general area. And we rotated them in different places in the fall and in June. We did a survey the first time, and this is a couple of the questions. Why are you disposing the medications? And the majority were because they were expired and no longer used. And in a lot of cases, they answered the same question with two different answers. And then what would happen if you wouldn't have been able to bring them into the MedDrop program? I see 60% of the people said they would have kept them. And that's why you find medications. We didn't find anything from the 30s, but we did find things from the 60s that were brought in and dropped off at the events. Our vision statement from the beginning was to work ourselves out of the take-back programs. We knew that that was the way we could start, but to have something twice a year for people to bring their medications was not what we really wanted to do. So we moved into the drop boxes, and law enforcement has been very positive in that area. We did receive some funds from the county government. The healthcare systems in Madison have been very helpful in providing some funds as well. There have been some grants that have been received through Clean Sweep, and some of the law enforcement agencies also received some grants to help in the cost. We require each of the local communities that have a drop box to pay a $1,000 fee. You know, pay for the box and some of the disposal. So you can see the permanent boxes then have been placed now in 12 sites in Dane County. So it really covers the county from east to west, north to south. There are a variety of places. Some of the law enforcement facilities have 24-hour drop in spots, and the others are within business hours. So it varies from location to place. And the Safe Communities has a website where they do have the hours on there for each of the drop box to be able to be the medication to be brought in and dropped off. So this was the pilot in November of 2010. There were two of them that were placed, and in the first 8 months collected 3,250 pounds of drugs that were delivered. We don't sort them. We weren't sure what the DEA rules were going to be if they only allow law enforcement to touch the drugs. We're clear on it, so everything goes into them. And we ask people bringing them in to put them into Ziploc bags with some medication and not bring the bottles with them. So we don't receive names in that situation either. So the law enforcement officials will go through the boxes. They do pull out inhalers and sharps and other things that get put in there that shouldn't be in there. And then everything is twice a year is taken down to Subject. In the last fall, we took 6,500 pounds down, and just a week or so ago, another 8,700, almost 8,800 pounds of medications were taken down. So it is growing. We felt the same way that over a period of time, the numbers are going to decrease. That has not happened. They continue to increase as we have even more police stations that have implemented the drop boxes. And I'm not sure that they will decrease over time.
Okay, I have a question just to start. So being a drug abuse advocate, prevention advocate. We were talking about that earlier about this question of what's driving the issue of take-back. You know, I think we have a lot of people here that are interested in the take-back, the end of life of the medication element. And so from that perspective of being an advocate, how much do you see that the advocates are kind of owning that power, if you will? Because there's a lot that it's if you can prevent a life from ending, right? It's huge. It's tough to make a connection between pharmaceuticals that we're taking, that are being excreted into water, or even flushing or into the garbage. The connection is much different. It's very, very direct. Is this something that the drug abuse prevention advocacy community has really taken on, or is it something they're still sort of looking at because it's such a huge issue that you're dealing with? And then there's take-back and that. Where does that fit with the whole psyche of the community?
The take-back is one part of it. And actually with Safe Communities, there are a variety of different sections that are looking at the whole issue of drug abuse. And as I mentioned this morning, law enforcement has really become involved from the overdose issue. And just seeing the number of kids that have gotten into medicine cabinets and taking these medications. And that's really helped spur the take-back programs or the drop boxes along. I don't know that they would have been as excited about it for just clean water, which is a good thing, but I'm not sure that they would have gotten involved without the overdose part of it. but we have mental health people involved in one section. We have a variety of pharmacy people who are involved with safe communities, law enforcement. So we're looking at it from a variety of different ways. Tom mentioned trying to get people to take their medications appropriately. And yes, if you're taking them appropriately, you're probably going to have less waste that will be there available. And so we want to get them out of the medicine cabinets to prevent the overdoses as well.
When I start making jokes when I'm not really meaning to, it's time to ask someone else your question.
Deb Hoffman from Ohio EPA. I don't know if I missed it. Did you say you guys had a restriction on, you said some veterinary office. Did you have a restriction on businesses being allowed to come?
Correct. We would only take from households.
Okay.
So we would not take from, there were some physician offices that wanted to drop things off. There were veterinary offices that wanted to drop off. But we would only take from households.
And what was your reason for that?
We wanted to be a small volume.
Okay.
Not to get in the large volume.
Because I actually get phone calls at my office, and, you know, so I've reviewed this answer with my hazardous waste group. And as far as I understand it, at least in Ohio, as long as it's not a hazardous pharmaceutical, that doctor's offices and veterinarians and things, at least in Ohio, can bring to collection events. I don't know if other states have found that.
Yeah, it was really the people that clean sweep that were feeling like we could not receive them from anyone but households.
This is a general question. This is about the Wilson and Carver County. When it comes to SHARP, I've heard a couple of people mention that, and I'm wondering if that's just an entirely separate part of the surgery issue, or if that's something that we're seeing in conjunction with the pharmaceuticals and kind of where everybody got on that.
You mean why do people bring them?
Well, no, because they come in with the pharmaceutical. There's always a problem for our collection boxes, and I'm not really sure what to do about that and what kind of a lay of the land and what to
do. Price search of white.
Yeah, well, yeah, a comment, but we looked at both of those issues, even separate but overlapping things. Quick way to say it. And I see more and more bills, like the Wisconsin bill, as they're looking at developing, does have a SHARP component to it. And the collection mechanism, you're not going to collect them in the same place, same container, but in the same place you can do that. So I see that there's overlap, but they are separate issues. From the product stewardship perspective, the manufacturers are the ones using the syringes to deliver their medication. So, that's just a delivery mechanism for the medication. So when we did our stakeholder dialogue, the consensus of the group was that if the pharmaceutical companies, again, that would be responsible for, starting the chain of the financing. So, you want to put it into the cost of the medications.
When we first started, we were under the impression that we could receive unused needles and syringes and EpiPens and things along those lines, but it changed, and most recently we've had to pull those out as well and then send them a total different direction.
Okay, thank you, Russ. Our last speaker, John Loffenschmidt from Covent, is talking about from the back end in terms of the destruction of the pharmaceutical.
Am I going the wrong way?
No, you're
going the right way. Keep going? Just a mention about our program. We started it in 2010. It was developed in partnership with PSI, and the roots of it went back to New York State DEC, which had originally done some work with trying to move pharmaceuticals out of normal disposal mechanisms because of groundwater contamination. Over the years, we had done some small programs locally, where we gave free disposal to some local take-back programs, and all I really did was bring it to a national program and got the buy-in from the company and kind of put together some of the talking points and stuff like that. And so our program is pretty simple. You send us an email, and we help you with the paperwork. And you get an authorization to go to a facility which is eligible to take it. Not all of our plants can take pharmaceuticals, either because of a state rule or a local rule. Some of them we run for municipal clients, and they may or may not allow us to do it. I have their no iodine containing products. It's really more of a joke than it is real, because really we don't want to take iodine containing products. We get a real lot of it. It makes the purple plume, which makes us unpopular with our communities. But obviously, if there's a small amount mixed into a large batch, it isn't. But it is the thing that makes our operating people uptight. So the paperwork is there, and I meet a lot of people that have used our program, and no one complains to me about our paperwork being a problem. And when I go past that group in my office, I always tell them they're the greatest, hardest working group in the company, and that keeps them going about wanting to support my program. So I just have a list here. You know, this is, we take a lot of non-hazardous products that are not just solid waste, and all I did here was just show, you know, the range of pharmaceutical waste products that may, you know, would be acceptable for us to take. So our program results to date, these are the end of 2012 numbers. We had taken a little bit over 600,000 pounds. I just have an update on that number of we're up to 865,000 pounds, and we're projecting to pass 1 million pounds by the end of this year. A lot of people who were previously not aware of the importance of using the household hazardous waste exemption are more knowledgeable in it now than they were a few years ago. Two states that have been generally slow to adopt progressive change have changed their rules, where they now recognize the use of the household hazardous waste exemption for pharmaceuticals. And likewise, some groups may not look at energy from waste as a environmentally positive service, but in the case of pharmaceuticals, where you clearly have the complete destruction of the product, there's no possibility for a groundwater contamination, which you would have, of course, with a landfill or with flushing. And the fact that it's truly non-retrievable once it goes into our unit. So we've become more accepted by the greener side of the house than we had been previously. We have a lot of partnerships with law enforcement and community groups that are doing these take-backs. And again, for us, as I mentioned a little later on, it's been positive for us from a public relations standpoint. And I was pretty surprised about the amount of articles that have been written about the program. And this is the end of 2012, 1,252 articles with 83 million page views. And that basically means that someone opened the paper or went to the website, not necessarily that they read that article. But if you sort of think about it, because all of us in one way, shape, form, or another are involved with imaging to the outside world, having ourselves mentioned in that many articles, you know, is viewed, for me, it's viewed positively inside the company. It helps me justify the program. So opportunities and challenges. You know, I started out looking at the collection and destruction from an environmental standpoint, and I've become far more moved about looking at it as an important step in preventing drug abuse. And so I see us as joining the chorus of people sending out messages. And I think one of the problems is that if we don't have take-back programs, we don't have imaging, let's say, in the pharmacy where someone sees the disposal location, if we're not always sending that message, people aren't going to take the drugs out of their cupboard and get rid of them. So I think it's important to always be messaging, because it's the only way. Once we get rid of those drugs, then they're not available for abuse. And I mentioned earlier, you know, we have a program called the Clean World Initiative, where we've tried to reduce our footprint, become more communicative to the outside world. So this program fits nicely into that program. As far as challenges go, you know, the household hazardous waste exemption, which I mentioned a couple of times today, we can't provide the service in a state without getting that. It's just that because if the state, which generally speaking the way it works, and I guess there could be a state that has embodied in the law, but in the end the state takes, you know, generally takes the federal rule and says we incorporate this into our state regulations, or we don't incorporate it and we do it on an exception basis. Unless we have that clearance in our paperwork, we won't be able to dispose of in that particular state. And then I think the, you know, product stewardship view and enhanced producer responsibility view of pharmaceuticals is something that needs to continue. That, you know, when we look at pharmaceuticals, if we solve all of the issues associated with the DEA regs, that will not solve the problem of drugs which are given away as samples, someone who needs five pills who gets 30. I mean, I think there's still a need for us to do other forms of product stewardship and enhanced producer responsibility to fully address the pharmaceutical question. As far as the DEA impact rule impact goes, I mean, it's not clear to me exactly what it'll be. I think a reasonable scenario is that the program that we've offered for free to any community in the United States or in really in North America, because we offer it to Canada as well, I believe that program will continue until such time as the pharmacies are up and running and they become the conduit for, then it would seem logical for the amount of take-back programs to go down once the disposal locations become ubiquitous. I think one of the mistakes that probably many in this room are making and the DEA is making is not following some of the guidelines that the National Research Council has given on sustainability to EPA. And I read a lot of articles about this kind of stuff, and this is probably one of the clearest documents that there is. You all have my PowerPoint on your, I never heard it, a jump stick. I always call it a thumb drive. But you have it on your, and you can just click on that location, and you can download it for free. But if you like a paper copy, it's $37. But I think one of the points that they make, and I think we should incorporate that this into all of our thinking, is that when we look at putting a rule together or putting a program together, we want to address the social, the environmental, and the economic. And I think if we skew to one or the other, our program won't be as good as when we balance the ones together. And the book does a good job of explaining that, and I would encourage all of you to read it as part of your summer reading. A mistake that is very clear in DEA regs is that they're not recognizing the opportunity for thermal destruction at different parts in the country. And I'll just use Long Island as an example because I've done a lot of work there. There are four plants on Long Island. They can all provide the destruction of pharmaceuticals in any way, shape, or form that they're collected. However, if the DEA rules mandate that a DEA registrant or a reverse distributor who takes them has to do it at their location to render it non-retrievable, and that location happens to be in Pennsylvania or in South Carolina, that seems to not make sense to sort of cause so much fossil fuel to be used and rather than finding a way to use thermal destruction. And I don't mean to denigrate any of the value in preventing diversion. I'm just saying is, why, if you have assets available to you, you're not taking advantage of those assets if they reduce costs and provide the same environmental benefits. And I mentioned this earlier, while there may be some instances where some hazardous waste, hazardous pharmaceuticals require special treatment, the odds-on bet is we can probably handle most of them, and there really is a need for us to understand what it means to have a hazardous waste designation and where it makes sense and where it doesn't make sense. state level and regional strategies? I mean, I just answered this question because this is what BSI asked. I mean, to me, in the end, if you can do it federally, it's the easiest, and so I'll call that a super region or a mega region. I think one of the tremendous opportunities that I see is, like, you know, obviously, I mean, my read of it, I think for sure pharmaceuticals are going to be identified locations. How they're going to get paid is not clear, and to me, I see the tremendous opportunity is that, you know, there is enhanced producer responsibility delivered on a platter, because if there's a contribution made at the manufacturer's level or end of life, and the end of life happens to be the pharmacy. I think when the question was asked earlier, who's gone to their pharmacy in the last month, I mean, there's really, to me, the real opportunity for us to properly take care of the end of life. You know, there's a number of programs that are out there that don't take controlled substances that are run by local you know, NGOs or governments. It's not clear whether they'll be in compliance with the DEA regs, and I think that's a missed area in their review of it. And if you don't communicate, you're really not going to be successful. And so no matter where you are in the process, if we're going to be effective at beginning to level out and then reduce the amount of deaths from drugs, we have to communicate effectively and have it be heard by the various interest groups. And I sort of mentioned earlier about pharmaceutical stewardship. I hope that we don't miss out on thinking about whether, you know, every prescription needs to be 30 pills. Maybe there should be some that are 15. And, you know, whether, you know, all those samples that are given out readily and the whole marketing campaign of the pharmaceutical industry, I'm not sure that's the right way to go. And I hope we don't forget about those parts of dealing with this as we work on these DEA regs. In conclusion, I think energy from waste has a role. I think we should never flush and don't let abusers have it. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, since we eliminated in its entirety, I think we're a reasonable location. And, I mean, I'm talking to you about the household hazardous waste. I think there's a whole bunch of issues in RECRA that made sense when they were done, and it's time for, we don't ever revisit anything. All we do is issue new regs and more regs and stuff like that, and we need to start to use a little bit of science and use a little bit of common sense and improve the overall quality of our programs, not only the quantity of those programs. With that, I'll say thank you very much. Have a nice day and a pleasant tomorrow. I view her a member of the left coast.
I have purple all over our southward region. It shouldn't be a person.
I actually meant left. Is that your face north there on the left?
Oh, okay. All right. We're in the other. So there was two things. One, we're seeing a lot of zero waste advocates getting very vocal in Alameda County about actually concerned that we're collecting pharmaceuticals to go to burning. And they're also saying that, you know, there could be radioactive drugs that are getting burned. Any response to that?
Well, there's a segment of the green side of the house which has historically been opposed to thermal destruction. So that, you know, that continues. I think if we use science and we look at, you know, are there impacts, what are the emissions, and compare them to, you know, regular things in life, I think we can probably come to an educated conclusion that these plants are designed and run in such a way that it's not a question about health impacts. To the question of radioactive material, all of our facilities have radioactive detectors coming into the facility. And so if we were to receive an unacceptable amount of radioactivity, which is generally calculated by clicks above background. So one of the things when people talk about radioactivity, they don't realize that, you know, there's a certain amount of radioactivity that is in our life all the time. And so when we run these, our equipment to test it, we're always looking for clicks above background, which will tell us we've got a problem with that truck. And just to give you an idea of the sensitivity, one of the things that happens in radioactive treatment of people is sometimes, you know, their innards and their defecation becomes radioactive. And so sometimes we have had drivers that have been wearing a diaper and they have defecated into that diaper, and we'll pick that up. And, you know, when it's picked up, we bring in the health authorities, we then check it, and it has, in some instances, been the driver. Now, there's two lessons, I think, in that. Number one is, if we're picking up a driver's radioactivity, that means that the clicks above background are relatively sensitive that we're picking that up. The other thing is, that same driver in his home could have taken that and put it into the waste stream. And so the only point that I'm making is that whether that waste goes to a energy from waste plant or it goes to a landfill, I mean, it's kind of, you know, in the system right now, so that any and it's unlikely that you're going to have a radioactive pharmaceutical product which is given to you. It's likely to be a product of treatment. And if that product of treatment was such that it triggered one of our alarms, we would be able to find it in the load, because we have done that.
Well, as I hope we've had the same thing happen, where we've got radioactivity sensor cameras that are going off, and it's probably coming from the adult lighters from the local retirement home. But, you know, I think that raises a bigger issue, though, that radioactive stuff is getting to you, and it's also getting into the water system. And I think we've got a bigger issue that we need to think about there, because we have more people on ecology units. I know hospitals are now looking at that have to set up water systems.
Yeah,
it's just something to think about, but for the people that are concerned about burning already, it just adds more.
Right, but the only
concern to them.
I think the only challenge, I think the most credible challenge to launch against a thermal treatment approach is to come up with actual data that shows that there's a problem. And, you know, the idea of radiation going up into the atmosphere, I mean, that, you know, from a burn plant, usually they're focusing on dioxins, they focus on mercury, and each one of those we measure, and each one of those, you know, we can look at the numbers and talk about.
Can you prove it's safe? Because that would help us a lot.
Well, if you're talking about the precautionary principle, I would argue that, you know, the precautionary principle is an argument from status quo. But I will make a deal with you. I will take your card, and I will make my best shot at giving you a body of information.
We're trying to support the fact that it's coming to
okay.
us, and we need data to prove it.
I will do that.
I just wanted to address the radioactive comment or concern. And if anybody has actually seen anything on the state, I'd like to hear it. But I've also gotten questions about that. A lot of people have called me that, what about radioactive stuff taken at pharmaceutical collections? And so I've called our Department of Health and spoken to the radioactivity experts, and they expressed to me that if it's done properly the way it should be by, like you mentioned, the treatment, there would never, ever be a radioactive pharmaceutical at a collection. And tell me if I'm wrong, but that's the way I understand it. You would never.
Well, I mean, the whole thing is these drugs are being managed by a radio pharmacist, and they're going to be administered at the facility. They're going to go back into the whatever's left, go back into the lead containers.
Right. Are there folks still on the phone line?
Back to ground level, or go back to the provider pharmacy, which is specialty pharmacy. So you're not given a hot pill to take home. That should never happen. Okay.
Thanks for all your advocacy. I really appreciate how you're getting the word out about the importance of drug feedback, and I appreciate your messaging shift from environment to the drug abuse. But when you advocate for saying that there should be this household hazardous waste exemption for all pharmaceuticals, I have problems with that. So I always cite Charlotte's analysis that 16% of drugs on the market probably categorized as RCRA federal hazardous waste. In Washington State, we have dangerous waste laws that categorize most medicines as dangerous waste. We are talking about that all the time because we want these drugs to be disposed of properly as hazardous and dangerous waste, which means not going into the landfill. So one concern I have about your messaging was saying, you know, these things shouldn't be called household hazardous waste. I feel like it just goes into the messaging of those folks who say, hey, throw it in the trash, mix it with some of that magic kitty litter, and it will all be fine. And that's not okay in my book. And so I'm going to come back to you, I think I've probably said this to you before, but if your waste energy plants are just as good of a destruction method as the hazardous waste incineration facilities, then please get them permitted as hazardous waste facilities because these chemicals are hazardous waste. So can you do that? What's the barrier to doing that?
Well, if you look at, I don't need that one.
I'm trying to get back.
If you look at the environmental controls. You said a lot of things that usually whenever Margaret says but, I always have to worry about what comes after. But I'm going to try to answer. Hopefully I'll remember everything you said. When you look at the controls, and I've given you all of this data, when you look at it from an emissions control standpoint, when you look at it from a thermal destruction standpoint, and you look at the products that we're talking about, you know, the challenge I put back to you is with, and there may be one or two products we can have a dispute on, but we'd have to walk ourselves through that. When you look at the performance characteristics of any MAC certified thermal destruction, so maximum achievable control technology, whether you're an energy from waste plant, whether you're one of the few remaining medical waste incinerators, or you're a hazardous waste incinerator, you're going to have the same performance characteristics on those products. So that's the reason why I say that it's valid for us to look at it. And when I talk about the possibility of using it, it's not so much about the details of, you know, each of those products and that we can discuss, but we can do that. And I think the number is more like 5 to 7% is hazardous, but I'll defer to you. Okay. So if you look at nursing homes, for example, which is one of our big problem areas, if in order for us to provide a service to them that makes sense from that social, environmental, economic perspective, if we're going to force anybody who wants to properly dispose of it, because it's too expensive for everybody to always be splitting, so they're going to put it together and ship it to a hazardous waste center, well, then you're going to spend a lot more money, you're going to go a lot longer distance. So when my advocacy for rethinking that has to do with the institutional members, and I think we can go through the full list of identified hazardous, RCRA hazardous pharmaceuticals, and if there's some there that have some special reason for us to say, you know what, it should go this other path, then we should make the unit, instead of it being 5%, maybe that comes down to being 0.1%, but it opens up the opportunity to have a number of other sources, which right now are doing things like flushing them or disposing them in landfills, or such into processes where they could be interdicted and go to abuse. I'm just trying to figure out a way to do it. The other thought is if we get big institutional players to cough up and do the right thing, we can add some community programs into that process and maybe get a much larger amount of drugs properly disposed of. So that's the rationale behind my thinking. But anything you're opposed to, I always respect.
Thank you very much. Thank you, John. I'm going to have to step in here. This is an interesting topic, and I encourage you all to continue the discussion. We can continue a little bit after the break. We had two 90-minute webinars that we did on this. It was sponsored about a year and a half, 2 years ago, almost. Ken Harper's representative and Clean Harbors on the line, and John from Covanta, because from some of our members, we have 47 states that are members, and some of them, we have King County and Washington, so they're members, and Maine is also in the same camp, and a number of other states, and then some are in the camp of accepting the solid waste incineration, waste energy. And so it's a complicated issue. We do have materials on that if you're more interested in your head around it. But it is, I appreciate the discussion, the respectful conversation, and there's a lot more to happen. So thank you very much, John.
On the phone lines. This is Scott Cassell from PSI. Might be on mute right now. Just want to know if there's people still with us. Anyone still on the phone line?
Thank you.
Us on the phone line? Dr. Phil?
I'm going to go ahead and do it. Come out,
will hopefully open up opportunities for flexibility collection, actually to fix some of the things that Charlotte and others here were talking about. We still have the funding issue. Right? So if we just focus on this bullet here, and then I'm going to open it up to whatever you want to talk about. Okay? But this bullet here, laying the groundwork, Steve, I'd like you to talk about it when it comes in. Because, you know, we've been working, you know, with you here in Wisconsin. You've got a model bill. And what are you thinking? When we were talking before, you were saying, okay, maybe we're thinking kind of think about this a little bit differently about how to gain support. Which legislator do we choose? Which, how do we form the coalition? Who's most important? So you want to share some of those thoughts?
Sure, Scott. The challenge, I'm looking at Frank over here, but anybody who's been working on environmental issues for years understands is, at, like any pollution prevention strategy we try to launch, we need top management support. That's just the way it's got to go. And if we're hoping that the industry is going to step forward and help with some of the financing of this problem, either we've got to garner some leadership out of the industry, ideally, as well as policymakers if it's going to be put into legislation. Peter Manley and I at the break were talking about how different this session is from where we were 2 years ago when we were struggling with just the basics of what's a good program. We've come a long way in 2 years. We understand that pretty well. We've collected a lot of old meds, and now we're talking about how do we move it forward. So we have drafted some model legislation in Wisconsin. We have some interest politically. The political winds have changed considerably from 2 years ago. And I think we need to rethink it. And I guess what I'm looking for from folks is ideas of who's out there and how you develop that support. We have a modest coalition. The Wisconsin Working Group represents a pretty broad group of people, but it's not enough to get legislation passed. And I need your guys' advice on what we do next.
Okay, so let's bring that out to the group here. So I'm going to look at Heidi and Margaret and others that have been working on this, Dave. Go ahead.
Well, the bill, because it takes so much to take on legislation of this type, especially considering what COVID is, which I would assume that is going to be the case at this point in time. So huge coalitions with people that do have a lot of problems. So in your state, I would look at who has the power with your legislators and your governor, and the key committee chairs that that bill would have to go through. And I would talk to all of them and get, you know, say, who is it that we need to work with to get on board so you guys can take this seriously? And maybe even say that what we'd like to do is start with, like we did, we had a joint committee hearing on EPR in general. That was a great idea because it was a bill in plan. Open up the discussion about the entire approach and the way you build the product. Make it here better. The opposition was an old very nice. But you should also do specifically on the content. In the best data, availability of water districts, your all these folks that haven't been brought together before, you start building their whole communication. That's how the best association, I never talked to them before. Them right after, you have to get really fast on building their coalition that first before they get any other story. So I would say start doing a lot of groundwork that way. And there's lots of different ways to do it. Talk to your key partners, calling communities and input to us. You've got a lot of political power, they have a lot of campaigns. Water districts have a lot of money, and they're very good at, you know, helping with funding for research. You've got Palo Alto that's build consistent data collection on what they're actually finding in the water. Water districts are making testing, really what it is we're looking for. So getting the building the case with really good numbers and good coalition to the point we can get start getting this like critical mass. We start to see, I
pharmacy staff before you make the decision. Some prior groups, we said, well, we get this and we want it still, but our bill is going to allow every county to set up their own program to pay for it. And from our perspective, we can't do that. And why? And from our perspective, we can't add costs onto our drugs. We're already trying to pay for our drugs. So we had to talk. So even with supporters, you have to work through the issues to make sure you're all clear. Then you see networks that exist. Like we're talking to NREC about using their whole network of alerts, their group that supports the bill. Same with Sierra Club, same with Clean Water Action, same with the retirement group. But we couldn't get money enough to pay AOP. But if we follow the money, I know who's getting the money from home, and you got to overcome that. And really, that's what we're coming to do that in very short.
Great.
And I can add a couple things. So when I first started working on the Washington state legislation, there was a little core group supporting it, but we realized we needed more support. And we needed more support that wasn't just viewed as the environmental side either. I mean, all really green legislators have been with us from the beginning, but in our case, that's not enough to pass a bill in either house. So we really have a very broad coalition. If you look at the Take Back Your Meds website, you can see a list of all our supporters. And it's sheriff and community. It's health and medical services. All the drug-free community groups have been amazing activists. Local governments, you don't know these groups, you get to know these groups. Now, what they know, everybody, and a lot of us turn out to be best friends with legislators. And this is, you're going to have to become very politically savvy. This is not an issue where you can just go to the legislature and think that you'll explain it at a hearing, and they'll go, oh, great idea, let's adopt it. You have to know each and every legislator on each city, count your votes every minute, and know who influences them and how you get to them. This is very hard for local governments because we don't do politics like that. But if you want to pass a EPR for medicine, you're going to have to get that savvy. Two other things I'll add, and we learned after 2 years, we had an awesome coalition. We still weren't there yet. Then we moved into the media. We said we really have to get this out of the back room of Olympia, State Capitol, and get it before people in the media. And we were placing opinion pieces. We were setting up editorial boards. It took 2 years to get the newspaper editorial boards to listen to us. The first year that we reached out to them, they said, well, we're not going to spend our editorial board time on that bill because it's a no-brainer. That will pass in a minute. After we got the stuffing beat out of us, we went back to them the next year, and then they met with us, and we had editorials in some of the meetings. So I would really encourage you that what Heidi is saying, get your ducks in a row, get your coalition together, you've got to know all your facts. And then the last piece of advice I'll say is, and this is a hard one, and I'm a scientist by training, so I'm very detail-oriented, and I'm way down there in the weeds, and I'm talking about this regulation and that regulation, and the science on this, and if you don't want to take back that, get your message simpler. The industry will go to your legislators and say, it's too hard to take back. They will say, all these comments about how DEA regs are barriers, you are killing your chances of passing your legislation every time you say that, because that's exactly what pharma says. It is premature to talk about creating a Medicaid Take Back program until the DEA regulations are finalized. Well, in my view, that's unacceptable. Kids are dying today. We know we can operate Take Back that law enforcement pharmacies make it work. We need the financing, we need the coordination. Those of you that can't get out of weeds, do not go to lobby. Right? Find people who can make the message simple. Get them with the fact. Get the personal stories out there. I'll stop pontificating, but it's really going to be that kind of a fight, and you're going to have to look at it.
There are lessons that you can apply to all EPR legislation. So, particular opposition here that's very Other comments, anyone else?
Carl, since the one thing that they briefly alluded to, Denver and the residents, seeing why Alameda champion. If there's not a political champion, lots of coalitions that give opposition in this context. And a champion is not just someone who's passionate about it, but listen to how he was able to articulate the issues associated with that bill. I've had people advocate bills on our behalf, really want to be champions, could no more do with the substance, or even a substance. So the champion is, I think, the most essential. Someone who is willing to take all the flack and put it against.
Some other characteristics of that person, how do you identify? Obviously, you know, Supervisor Miley could take on Schwarzenegger any day. But what about characteristics? What do you see, the characteristics that he has or others that need to have to pass to be the point person on EPR legislation?
They can't be threatened. I don't know Alameda County. I lived there, but I don't know about. And he wasn't going to. Okay. So they couldn't mount a campaign to budget. So you have to find someone who can rise above the threats of money getting reported to the competition or. That is absolutely critical. My opinion is that would be someone who has already power. So committee chair of the responsible committee is ideal. That's the first place I always go. Not that, then try to find something that makes sense with leadership.
In the leadership. Yeah, they got to be someone that their caucus respects, too, because they're going to be in the middle of this firestorm of debate. So if you have someone that has a really respected reputation that perhaps can sway others or have other people will follow their lead, and to know that, you've got to talk to people, know your legislature, and have that input.
In any legislature, there are 3 or 4 or 5 people, max, to get a bill through, any kind of stuff. And without one of those people, no significance. How did you make that assessment?
Actually, I've got in Alameda County, I was invited to the meeting, the first stakeholder meeting I had with Marjorie Powell, who's a lawyer for pharma, and there were 5 supervisors, their attorney, Gay, Sarah, and me, and some people. By the end of that meeting, I said, we've got to help them. Because it wasn't just Supervisor Miley, Gay, Fox Dollar, she won an award from NACA, from her advocacy children's their county supervisor staff were so irritated with the response they were getting from the staff that walked out. They weren't going to take this. And I thought, okay, if they're going to be brave enough to take this on, we're going to help. But without a team like that, I wouldn't even try because it is.
Anyone else? Okay. Thank you. Thank I hope this is of interest. Here, but if it's not, we can shift to another topic. Everyone, you are now, Bill.
I was going to add, we must have also doing something with ordinances. We went to our department in California for safety reasons, and it's still on the table, let me put it that way. We have to suggest that they want to look instead of, especially ideally, if we can get it in federally.
I can say one thing, pharma has the most power at the national level and the least power at the local level. That's why we can start local and push up. Not very many counties have a pharmaceutical company, and that means Alameda has several.
HOA. We're represented by lobbyists at all stakeholder meetings, and we were getting opposition letters from mayors before the last adoption hearing. And we called the lady, we couldn't get through the firewall of all their secretaries and stuff. We get a real person, someone has an audience. And we asked them, why are you opposing the bill? And she said, well, I just got back this morning from the California Health Care saying we should oppose it. You didn't know? We had county supervisors at the hearing months before saying, are you filing your letter? They said, oh, they all know. Well, they did not know. They got that fax letter signed in and opposed. That's what you're going to do.
Well, I mean, anything else on ECR end? Anyone here thinking about how do I do this? Questions along that line?
Has it always been partisan for those of you who have pursued it? Has it always been bipartisan?
Never
been. Well, we started pretty bipartisan in California, and we were doing resolutions. Out of 500 jurisdictions. It was urban, rural, left, right. It was all because people were getting this business market approach.
I guess I mean the vote, like the actual vote.
But when it got to the state capital, and even the people who voted for it at the local level, a local party, they get to the state capital, all of a sudden, off the state capital. So, and they went this way and that way, and we had straight party lines.
So in Washington State, Nova's first instance of the state, we had a critical care nurse who was a Democrat who heard about pilot programs that Mike Galvin and others worked on, and she thought, and she heard about the DC program, and she put out a bill. And at that time, we had this really great House Environmental Health Committee, which had Democrats and Republicans, but they were pretty diverse in environmental health. And there was a hearing held on the bill, and it got passed out unanimously. So almost half the vote were Republicans. And then the pharmaceutical industry woke up and started fighting it. And ever since then, it's been quite partisan. We have always had champions on the Republican side of the aisle. But frankly, what happened in our Senate, where we were close to passing it, we couldn't get the votes of a few conservative Democrats. So let me be clear. Some of the Democrats have a problem too. But so we're missing a few Democratic votes, which meant we had to pick up a few Republicans to pass the bill. And that's where pharma got us every time. They put so much pressure on the Republican caucus that those Republican supporting legislators would hold couple of steps with us, but that's where the pressure point was. So unfortunately it's been very partisan. Now, let me say at the local level, when I mentioned our two champions, Mayor David Baker of Kenmore, who's our local knight in shining armor on this, is a Republican. And he doesn't understand why this should be part of this. And the sheriffs that I have going to the legislature and lobbying are Republicans. And they don't understand why it should be part of this. But this is going to be one of the problems you're going to have. And I think that farm and money influences both parties, but the Republicans are even more successful. Right now. And I know there must be Republicans in the room. Go to your party and say, why is that? Because this is public safety. It shouldn't be
law enforcement. Wasn't that the biggest driver, really?
Well, and that's part of why we got law enforcement so engaged, because we were like, how can these folks say no to their sheriff? And yet they have so far, which shows farmers' power.
Hi, I was wondering if you could address your comments earlier about AARP and not being involved in it, but
they get a lot of money.
hearing on a chart, pretty happy to go on. All of a sudden, I got like 12 letters sent to all the committee members, parents who have children with stress hormones. But somebody's behind this. I said they were from that one very specific group. So he did a Google search and found this nonprofit in Georgia that had blogged, the mothers had children with disorder and had blogged about how horrible the film in California is, people would not be able to afford the medicine. So I called him, and I said, you know, we're sponsoring the bill, we never want hurt children, let's talk to you about it. Well, this is terrible, but it was done. And I'm like, where did you hear about this? He never did say, but we did find links from several of the large manufacturers who thought it was children's case had directed that lesson, funded her organization, and the feeling is actually, now, this is where the money is implementing, and innocent people are being used as tools of hope. And this is what they're up against. We didn't even know, you know, what to expect. So I talked to her, I started, and she said, well, it doesn't happen in Canada. I thought, that sounds interesting. That sounds interesting. That's what the guy said from the Northern Order is hearing. He actually said that my testimony was in Canada. I said, well, everything in Canada was all this term. As he left the hearing, I actually said, sir, I actually have a copy of the entire regulation here. I'm happy to give it to you. And I was like, and he said, I know it's all in there. And they called, I heard that you, at our counter in the hallway, that I push you. I don't know who you're talking to, or this is what you're going to end up doing. This is not pretty. This is sausage factory gets worse. But as long as you go in knowing what you're going to
and you but it follows the money, build your possessions. So, guys, I just want to be sure that you understand. In Washington State, AARP did do actual work. Everything Heidi just said is absolutely true and works. It's not been pretty false, but we had supported the Washington State Senior Citizens Lobby, of which AARP is a member. It took us a lot of time working with them, but in the last session, they did do actual work. Almost every health and medical group, you're going to have to answer the question about impacts on price of medicine. They're all worried about that. I would say the bigger problem that we've had with the big medical groups like heart, lung, and cancer can't get this in their top three priority list. So, and I would say that it's going to be a challenge with your coalition. We have a very broad coalition. Only a subsection of our coalition has this as their number one issue. That's a challenge. Because the health and human services groups are generally focusing on state budget problems.
Yeah. Margaret, I have a question for you, I guess, from the PSI standpoint, and then you guys. I found something when I was looking this morning when we were trying to find out costs. I found something on the CDC website. They have really great information. And they said that the use of opioid pain relievers cost health insurers approximately $72.5 billion annually in healthcare costs. So given something like that, which is coming from the CDC and not a lobbying group, wouldn't the insurance company friend in this?
So when you go talk to legislators too, on this is one of the issues where everyone does this. Your responsibility is your responsibility. So, and you know the drug companies don't want responsibility, and they're very powerful. So there are some people that say, the doctors should say, it's all over-prescribing, the doctors should do. Oh, it's those health insurance companies, they should do. So there's a lot of that going on.
Pharmacists and retailers, that they should pay for.
And, you know, what frustrates me is that those other people, the fickle finger of spending is coming at, doctors, health insurers, retailers, they are not stepping up to help us fight pharma. They're kind of happy that they're doing this CYA a little bit and not really stepping up to help us. And on that, you know, I don't know, working on them. I mean, at some point, I think John said it too in his presentation, he thinks that pharmacy is supporting the stewardship approach because otherwise they may end up paying for it.
taking this as an example, I mean, here's a cost issue. So one question would be, put this in the tax money, for example. Like, here's this big cost for drug abuse, if you can reduce that drug attention, you can presumably reduce that cost down. Shouldn't that be a cost saving? We hammer on the cost savings in various ways on other types of bills. Is this something that you think you would...
We did it. I mean, on our website, we figured out, we took national data. We said each year in Washington State, we spend $6.2 million to hospitalize and treat children from unintentional poisoning, $9.3 million for ER room costs, $6.2 million in accidental overdose deaths. And then what they throw back at us, and here, remember, I'm a scientist, so this one kind of hits me in the heart. Show me one scientific study that shows that states exactly how much medicine take back will reduce bar visits or drug overdoses or abuse. And, you know, and I let's just say, well, give me the $100 million it would take to try and do that study, and where do I do the study, because we don't have take back that's comprehensive anywhere to study it. But so that's the pushback, Scott. I mean, it will be a war of facts. Yeah, it goes back and forth. And again, as a scientist, what really bothers me about the whole process is how every fact that our side has put out, we have had to document and prove, you know, where did that come from, how did you get it, what's the source. Pharma runs in and says things that, I mean, you're never supposed to call something a lie down there at State Capitol, so I would say not exactly representing the truth as most people would understand it. But, and they're never asked where to get it from. So all I can say with that is you just have to be even better and more nimble than them, and you have to keep putting their misinformation hat on.
It's all part of the past.
Yeah.
So people who are trying to pass something are generally held to higher standards. That's false. And patient. The facts of them.
At 90% of the time, I've never seen it. Legislators demand that show us the study that you're citing that says 99% of pollution is garment is from pollution. The most detailed response we got so far is, oh, the Pharma National Office is working on getting this. We never saw it.
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, sometimes when you have these insoluble problems, the high enough above it, maybe you can find another way to do it. So based on what Michael was talking about with, you know, pharmacists consulting and all that, so what if there was a way to resolve CMS so that if prescribing, if the money was put into prescribing and people taking the meds right and so forth, that the money that would be saved from CMS, whether it's Medicare or Medicaid, for proper drug usage, that there could be a small percentage of that taken to use for the take-back program, so that it's not the drug company directly funding it. A couple of things would happen. Either they sell the same amount or more drugs because people were actually using the medication correctly. They might actually sell less drugs, so there could be less but wouldn't it be interesting if the money, just like, you know, who's paying for the DEA take-back program? People who buy the DEA registration, right? Isn't that where the money's coming from?
I assume.
I believe it is. I think it's coming from the registrants. And I think our gentleman's not here right now from the DOJ. But I think that's where the money comes from. So there is money in the system, and there's money to be saved in the system. And if we could figure out a way to get to that level and say, let us show you how working together save money, but then when we do, a piece of that has to go to the take back, the public health.
That would require federal dollars.
Yes.
But
there's no reason for pharmacy to control good drugs. They can't get out there and say to a legislator, I want people to misuse their drugs, not take their meds, so I can sell more.
But it's not going to impact them overtly on their bottom line, on their budget. When we started reimbursing individuals, they absolutely hated us. Because they didn't buy, like, people actually turning their drugs and getting money back for the way they offered it. I became weird from somebody said they get on more than that and all they want to use it. So if you can figure out a way to do this, it doesn't impact everybody's bottom line to do the other thing. And takes money in the system to come up with it. There's a way to do it. Somebody wants it. Don't you really want the drugs to be handled correctly and paid out of something other than local funding?
Taxes?
No, it isn't taxes. It's savings by not having someone in with an ER.
Even special
workers. Yeah, but it's the money that you're spending now because people aren't using Medicaid. You're turning in your blood pressure, which is in the medical system, to cost the system, including your
I think you're asking good questions, and we've mulled over some of these things in our own state. But here's the thing, when you think about it, so saving money in healthcare, one or more of the current players in healthcare lose money. And the health insurance are very powerful. I mean, so this is the problem, is that you're trying to then accomplish the funding for take back through a change in our health care system. I'm not sure that's any easier.
I mean, maybe it's not easier, but I think it would be a better outcome to decrease the amount of waste, have better health care outcomes, and develop the take back turning out more drugs than the take back.
That's a very good discussion.
Come to the dialogue, maybe next month.
Yeah, sure. No problem.
Well, I thought it was an interesting idea to not actually did come up in our pharmaceutical discussion 5 years ago. This issue of the working with CMS and the whole, I mean, it's a whole other world. Wind us down, just to see if there's any other thoughts, comments, anything people have. I kind of wanted this open. We wound it kind of tight through the whole day with a lot of different stuff going on. I just wanted to see what comes up. So, hope you see it. We'll go 1, 2,
Anthony Pablo of the Iowa Pharmacy Association. I'm taking this all in. But one other program that we also have going on in Iowa, our pharmacy association operates a very expansive medication for the last year. But we actually also have, kind of like through IPA, but through the state, and there's a drug repository program that is set up after legislation. But we kind of talk about some of these medications coming out into the public from a distributor standpoint. We're talking a lot about long-term care facilities. And what this drug repository program does, basically the product is, you know, somewhat of a controlled environment, usually long-term care center, unit dose packaging. Those products, as long as it's still a 6-month expiration date, tend to be repurposed and redistributed to patients that actually don't need it. Another great program that we were actually able to help and assist with getting started in Iowa. I don't have numbers on it, but it just seems like there's a lot of things around the country. Another good mechanism to get rid of these medications out of cabinets, but out of the room, we don't need them anymore. But another mechanism, I think.
Only got 5 minutes left, and I know we're at a hard stop at 4:30. That clock is 3 minutes from 11.
I just want to say thank you to Jim and Margaret and all of the that's what we do. You know, we just keep going. Keep the fight. It's worth it. It'll pay off. And all of you young people, you got to take on for all of us. And I was just, we're putting together
California. What we got, the questions from pharmaceutical companies, as their agents built, and we're doing the answers to that. We're happy to share that because you'll probably all get the same exact questions. And if you have better answers, then we can all build off of those. And just for supporters, the Retailers Association statewide has been very helpful. That they do not want over the counter. That's a lot of them brands over the counter. That's just something to know. But you need to get the retailers on your side. That's why I'm going to be sure to reach out to your department. County Health Officers, LA County, but LA County Health Officer is very interested in talking to us and talking about what we can do to help. She's very concerned about drug demand, sure. The press, we hired a press person, made a huge difference going to the public and getting more public support to get your legislators covered and take on some decisions. Pharmacists Association has been extremely helpful. Pharmacists get it. They do it all the time, and they are very supportive. And in fact, the pharmacy schools in California got 5 free students that are
I just wanted to say that the King County's rule regulation, which Knockwood will be enacted next week, does include over-the-counter medicine. And I can give you stats and talking points on why it's really important to the counters. They are important. We are walking a very narrow line. We let the store brand owners off the hook, but we are capturing the manufacturer of the drug. Big companies like Corrigo that make all the drugs for Walmart, Kroger, and most of the other big So I think there's a way, rather than just dispensing over the counter, you might just have to give on the producer definition. And last thing I want to say is I hope that, I want to share, and I'm glad that Heidi and I had a chance to share with you the reality of what it's like to run this legislation, but please don't let us discourage you. There's a tipping point coming here. I feel it. I believe it.
Yeah.
It will only happen if we keep pushing.
Yeah.
So please listen, learn from our school hard knocks, but do not let it stop you.
We're just trying to keep you from, you know, hitting all the pitfalls that we hit.
Yeah.
I think both of you started us with